is nowhere near enough to really argue through all these cases. Let me just tell you one quick anecdote, or it's more than that. It's an actual case I consulted on. It has nothing to do with hoarding. But I just want to sort of put a nice little neat cap on everything we talked about in the first part here and give you a sense of what you need to be thinking about as we head into these case studies. We had a guy come into the hospital who was complaining of some chest pains. Are you picking up the sound better now? Excellent. I went for the lav, so they'll have high quality sound. All right. There we go. So he comes into the hospital complaining of some chest pain, and this was, around 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. And they evaluate him quickly in the ED, and it turns out that he has got, like, scary blockage going on. And the attending in the ED said, "You are so lucky you walked in. Like, your heart is about to explode. You have no time to waste. I just called over to the cath lab. We are sending you now. Like you're going to go from here to the cardiac unit, and they'll take care of you." I don't even know if they were going to cath him or they're going to do open heart surgery for bypass. But this guy's like going to die. And he says, "No." Literally, I don't have time for that. What he says is, "I have a lunch meeting." No. Before you laugh, listen to this. He says, "Listen, I have a lunch meeting. I have been working my entire adult life building my business. I am now selling my business. This is worth millions of dollars. I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars. Like this is the culminating moment of everything I have spent my adult life working for. I am closing the deal at lunch. I am going to do nothing to jeopardize closing this deal. I am going to walk out of this hospital. I'm going to go to this meeting. I will be back here." By then it was probably 11:30 or so. He says, "I will be back here in an hour and a half. Have the cath lab waiting because I want to enjoy my retirement now that I'm going to be a multimillionaire. But first things first. I'm going to lunch. I'm selling my business. He's going to sign the contracts. Trust me, as soon as the ink won't be dry, I will get back over here and I will submit to whatever health care I need to in order to take care of my heart, but I'm walking out of the hospital right now." And immediately, wouldn't you know, what happens? Well, psych consult, yeah, but even before that, ethics consult. My phone goes off because now the question is, we have to hold this guy in the hospital. Can't we hold this guy in the hospital? No. He's making a really stupid decision here, and he could die. He might not. I mean, we freaked when we saw his test results. The guy could die any second. We've got to hold him, put him in 4-point restraints, and cath him.
Nope. All right.
Okay, so I don't want to get into a long conversation about this case, but I'm throwing it out there because I want you to recognize, if you are willing to say that someone like that can leave the hospital, now what you would do, and as you just suggested, is you're not going to write a discharge plan that says, I am releasing you from my care, come back in an hour and a half, and I'll readmit you to the hospital. You're going to write a note that says, "I advised him that he was an idiot. I really think that this is stupid. I advised him of all of the risks he was taking. I encouraged him to stay, da-da-da-da-da," and then get him to sign an AMA release, so an against medical advice release, right? So you're going to leave the hospital AMA. Okay. By the way, is there anyone in the room who thinks we should hold this guy and force treatment on him? Anyone? Not a one. All right, this is, yes?
No, I was just going to ask, wouldn't they be obligated to offer some kind of alternative?
Well, they should, well, I don't know, like, let's quickly jam a pacemaker in you, or, there is no other alternative. I mean, the least invasive alternative here is going to be to get him into the cath lab, and I honestly can't remember if the guy needed bypass surgery or just they were going to put a balloon in him or whatever, but the point is he had massive obstructions, and there was no less invasive way. I mean, I suppose here's a jug full of Coumadin, drink up. But the guy wanted to leave. Now, if there's no one in the room, Just notice this. If there's no one in the room who believes that we should be able to hold that gentleman over his objections in order to try to save his life, notice the power of the argument I made in the first half, especially on the paternalistic argument. It is clear that there is a clinical indication to treat this guy. It is clear that there is no less restrictive alternative. It is even clear that cathing him does him far less harm than him dying. In fact, even giving up on a multi-million dollar sale of a business in order to keep yourself alive is a good deal, right? I mean, if you asked me what I would do for $10 million, I would do a lot. But if you asked me if I would die for it, the answer would be no. I might jump out of a plane to see, but only with a parachute. So clearly this guy is making decisions that we think are unreasonable. That is, we disagree with this. But as we were talking before, I can't remember about the subjectivity of value. I think it was right. For him, this closing this deal was more important than anything else, and he was willing to take this risk in order to do it. He was informed of the risk. He was capable of understanding the risk. He took the risk upon himself. We don't hold him. Keep that in your head when we look at these cases, because there are going to be any number of people who are doing things that we think don't make sense, and that might even be demonstrably wrong for them.
Did he make it?
He did. He did make it.
He made it?
He did make it. I can tell you stories where people don't make it if you want to hear those. But notice how it would change. Notice how it would change if he came in and it wasn't a heart condition that he had, but it was Ebola. Okay, so now you notice. You see how you shift from the paternalistic argument. You test whether or not it works. You determine it doesn't work. Then the only other, either you let him go or you examine. Are there any other rationale? Is there any other rationale for holding him? What's the only other rationale there could be? Distributive justice. If he meets those conditions, maybe we can quarantine him or something. Although, again, we'd get to who has the authority to declare a quarantine, right? So there's a role issue there. But if... Excellent. Someone with seizure disorder who says, I don't want to be on my anti-seizure meds. Should we hold them down and force them onto their seizure medications? Answer, if they have capacity, understand the alternatives, risks, and benefits, they say, I'd rather risk seizures than the meds. We say, fine, but we're calling the DMV because the distributive justice, now notice it's the least restrictive alternative here now, taking your license away from you is less of a harm to you than it is to... the person who gets killed by you when you run over them, right? Or, in fact, we had a case. It wasn't this CSB. We had a case at a different CSB. Don't worry, we're getting hoarding. Another CSB, woman comes in, confides during a clinical encounter that she's not on her seizure meds, but she says, don't worry, because I can always tell, you know, a few seconds before I'm going to have a seizure. And I pull over, and I don't drive on highways or anything else. This is confidential information that has been revealed in a counseling session. Okay? Can you take away your license? Quick answer, no. But you know, we got an ethics consult on it. And you know what happened next? All you DFS people are going to love this. We examined, during the ethics consult, we asked about the seizures and about what she said. And as long as she was reporting, look, I have a seizure disorder, and I'm not taking my meds, there was really not much we could do. By the way, if someone reports in a confidential clinical exchange, I stole a car last night, there's nothing you can do. Okay? She's not threatening to kill anybody. There's no identified victim. None of those statutes apply. But when we examined... So what kind of, you say you're not on the highways, what kind of driving do you do? Well, just little errands around town, you know, picking the kids up from school and dropping them off at the... Ah, what happens then? It's CPS time, right? I can't report her because she's risking harm to herself. She has a right to do that. She may be an unwise decision, but paternalism didn't work there. But as soon as she mentioned that she had dependent children, that is children that she was in the care providing role for... And she was now driving with a known seizure disorder without taking her meds. Bingo, we have everything we need to breach confidentiality because, as mandated reporters, we have to report to CPS, not APS in this case, but CPS, any suspicion that there exists an abused or neglected child. So think about all of that structure when it applies to these cases. There are going to be times when people get to say, yeah, it's hoarding, but none of your business, or maybe no insight at all, just shut up. Then there are going to be cases where they have diminished capacity. There are going to be cases where other people are at risk. So we need to parse out. We really need to tease out all the details of these cases. There were a couple hands in the back there just a moment ago. Did they die? That was very polite.
I was going to say, did the hospital have a history of this man and with any psychiatric incidents coming to the hospital?
Ah, well.
Notice
what you just did, and it's a beautiful way to finish this section and then move on to these cases. If you want to preserve the paternalistic argument for the guy who came in with the chest pains, if you think it could work, notice what you're doing, and it's the right way to go. You're verifying that, in fact, the four conditions that I gave you are not satisfied. So if you introduce the fact, okay, that this gentleman has fixed delusions about being a business mogul. But in fact, you know, he's a homeless guy on the street. There is no business that he's selling. There is no multi-million dollar deal. And now he's refusing cardiac treatment because of a fixed delusion that he has about how important a business lunch is. We would now be in a position to trigger Angela, right? And say, whoa, 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 he does not have the ability to take responsibility for the consequences of his behavior because his decision is secondary to diminished capacity. He does not understand the alternatives. Well, he understands the alternatives. He can either go to the business lunch or get my heart taken care of. But what he doesn't understand clearly are the risks and, more importantly, benefits associated with his choice, because he's assuming that the benefit of going to lunch is $20 million in his pocket. There is no $20 million. So he is not assessing risks and benefits in any rational way, secondary to his psychotic illness. Therefore, paternalism's back on the table, and we might very well at that point we'd move him to the emergency room, and we'd get him evaluated on a TDO. We would get an ECO on this guy. We'd get him evaluated by the mental health evaluator. Well, there shouldn't be. Okay, good.
All I can do is TDO into the psych unit.
The fine.
Doctor has to call the
fine. There's no such thing as a medical TDO.
Yeah, I see them. Get them all.
They don't exist. They don't exist because the first box on a medical TDO is that the person lacks capacity to make this decision.
So the doctor has to.
Fine. All right, we'll get the right person to do the right evaluation, right? But the point is this, you'd have to be, in order to hold him, you would have to be able to establish that he is at risk and that he is incapable of understanding the implications of that risk, and that therefore we're going to move towards civil commitment on the grounds that he's manifestly unfit to care for himself. Sure. Well, we want to send this guy to a psych hospital and get him some psych treatment. I see your point. Yes. We'll get the magistrate to sign off on the cardiac stuff. I see your point. Yes. Let's not get into too many details here. What we want to do is treat his heart first. We're going to worry about his psychotic illness later. We're going to deal with his heart first. I see your point. My point would be you can't hold him simply because he has a cardiac problem. You can only hold him if his cardiac problem is something that he can't make decisions about because of his diminished capacity. You have to establish that he has diminished capacity so that the magistrate, and this, believe me, depending on the imminency, this can go a lot of different directions. Getting a legal guardian, get a guardian ad litem, blah, 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 blah. There's lots of ways it can go. But the core point is diminished capacity. No diminished capacity, no paternalistic argument, he leaves. If he leaves with Ebola, switch to a different kind of argument, and you may or may not be able to make that stick depending on the standards I gave you for that. So how does all of that, where's my doohickey? So how does all of that apply? Tell me what to do. Ms. A is a 60-year-old female client, multiple health concerns, history of prescription drug abuse. She has mobility issues, lives alone in a townhome. Received numerous reports from law enforcement, community members, and healthcare providers stating that there are trash bags, boxes stacked inside Ms. A's foyer and a strong odor coming from the home. outside of Ms. A's home is overgrown. House is in need of repairs, including broken windows. She often has her water, electric, and or gas services cut off. Clinical personnel state that Ms. A has capacity, refuses to allow anyone to enter her home. Neighbors are concerned about a reduction in their property values.
Are we approaching this from a governmental or just a strictly social?
Well, welfare. As it was said somewhere over here, you could take a civil. You could take a civil approach, but before that happens, the reason that this case gets on our radar screen is because there's a neighbor out there or someone out there who's terribly concerned about Ms. A. Not just like selfish people in the room concerned about their own property values, but actually concerned about Ms. A and whether or not she's safe, okay? And they call APS. So APS has to field the case. So let's start with that. So APS gets the phone call, all right? Obviously, I've sort of built it in here, although I didn't build it in, you built it in for me because you gave me this case. Obviously, some level of analysis has already taken place because staff are comfortable in the assumption that she has capacity. Okay, so you're probably right. There have been a series of phone calls. You've gone out. You've talked with her. You do not have evidence that she lacks capacity to make her own housing decisions. She's not dependent on anyone else's care, but she sometimes does lose water, electric, or gas. So let's start, number one, with what does APS do? And then if APS, based on what they say, then let's do the follow-up question, are there other avenues of response? Abby?
I think it says she has capacity, so I would say they're well set.
So Abby says you have to make sufficient follow-up to... Now, let's be careful about burden of proof, because I was just going to say something bad. I was just going to say you have to verify capacity. That's wrong.
You have to
prove incapacity. What you can't, it's not your job to verify that she has capacity. It's your job to verify that there's no reason to think she has incapacity.
But sometimes we have to verify capacity.
But you're never really verifying.
You're
not really verifying capacity. What you're doing is verifying the lack of incapacity. It is
right.
A subtle, but from an ethical perspective, hugely important point.
Same clinically.
Uh-uh.
Well, similar clinically, like in our work. Whether has it or doesn't.
No. I got a business lunch I got to get to.
Take a lot more
capacity than she has capacity if you can't prove it.
I'm saying, yes, I'm going back to the concept of the default. The default assumption is that she has capacity. She's under no pressure to prove that she has it. If you want to intervene, you have to prove that she lacks it. So you certainly do have to verify your judgment, but what you ought never to do, because frankly, you don't even have the authority to do it, is to certify capacity. You can't go in and say, I can prove she has capacity because she passed a mini mental status exam. What you're doing is going for the null outcome. You're saying, I can't prove she has diminished capacity.
Well, can I argue that clinically?
Sure.
Realistically? One of our regs is to protect people.
Good.
She may be the subject of a lot of emotional stress from her neighbors.
Good.
That's a possibility, and emotional abuse is part of elder abuse.
Okay.
So if I certify that she has capacity, you can use that information, because with APS I don't need her consent within the first 40 days of investigation.
Right.
To go back to the neighbors and say, back off.
That's fine.
And I'm protecting her.
That's great.
Emotional stress on her.
I love it. I agree with you. I just don't like your sloppy language. Okay? We're friends. Don't
not
worry.
Yours.
No. This is why. Because what you said was, I want to verify she has capacity, dot, dot, dot. And my point is that she has capacity until she's proven to lack. In fact, the Code of Virginia says that. The Code of Virginia that says that all adults are considered to have capacity until they're explicitly found to lack it, and that, in fact, carrying a particular clinical diagnosis is not evidence of diminished capacity. In other words, You have to actually be evaluated by appropriate personnel, two physicians, one physician, one licensed clinical psychologist, blah, 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 in order to take away your capacity. So what you're verifying there is what you're saying. I mean, we're saying the same thing, but from an ethical perspective, I really want to separate this out. You're not putting your name on something, or at least you shouldn't put your name on anything that says, I can attest to the fact that she definitely has capacity.
But a psychologist could if she...
No! Psychologists don't do that. They assess incapacity. Unless the person has already been found to have diminished capacity, because it takes two opinions to determine that you have diminished capacity, but any single physician can reverse a finding of diminished capacity and say, actually, I think they regained capacity, because as you pointed out before, right, it can come and go, and right? So I know this seems like I'm nitpicking, but the reason I'm stressing this so hard is that I don't want to lose our understanding of where the burden of proof rests. She's considered to have capacity until we can prove to lack it. Now, what you can write is, I examined her. If I were writing your note, I had an interaction with her, and I have no reason to believe she has diminished capacity. In your language, you might say, I verified she has capacity. I even agree with that. I agree that you can say she has capacity because she doesn't have capacity because you said she had it. She had capacity because she had capacity when she turned 18 and you couldn't say otherwise. So you can verify. Okay, good. All right.
Yeah, we can agree.
All right. So she retains her capacity. That's it. We're done, right?
No more.
Well, I know. Yes. But hold on one sec. Go here. Good.
And this is the issue of, so they've gone in, protective services have been called. They're saying that she's just a mean old woman and she doesn't want anybody in the house. What is the next step? What is the, what are those that are concerned about are supposed to do? What are the other issues?
Excellent question. And
hold on, let me
because I know where you're going to go. I heard what you said just a minute ago, and I want to hold that just for a second. It's a good point, but I want to hold it. I was going to say I don't want to make you frustrated, but actually I really don't care. So I'm going to make you frustrated. There may be lots of things that can get done, but none of them will have anything to do with forcing an outcome. So at some point, if we rule her out for diminished capacity, and effectively what APS then says is, she's not an impaired adult. She's got problems, but there are lots of people with problems and they refuse treatment all the time. Think about how many people in substance abuse just say, I deny I have a problem. I don't want to go to AA. Well, should APS go and drag every substance abuse addicted individual to treatment? Or what we generally argue is there, you have to be ready to, right? So what I would say here is, if the neighbors really care about her, they need to approach her and explain why they're concerned, and they need to offer her support. Do you need a ride maybe to see a counselor? Is there anything we can do to help you? There are lots of nice supportive things you can do, but none of them will involve the force of government to take her out of her home or steal her stuff from her. It's still her private property.
But you're talking about the clinical, and there's so much you can do with establishing rapport. We have an obligation under our regs to do due diligence. So we're going to try to
offer her sources of referral. You're going to
work. Another one might. We're going to call code about the power off. That's not cool. We might force that through that avenue. We might talk to the neighbors about how they can be more supportive.
But none of that's a question of forcing anything.
None of it. But if there's clinical work to be done, so if people have heartburn about the fact that we can't just leave her alone, that's accurate. But we also can't hammer her towards an immediate conclusion that we want.
And at some point, quite frankly, APS signs off, because APS is there to worry about protecting impaired adults from abuse, neglect, or exploitation. Once it's determined that there is no abuse, no neglect, or no exploitation, no matter how bad the circumstances are, it's no longer APS's headache. APS at that point should hand the case off to the CSB and say, if this woman wants to enter into services and she may or she may not. But the point is, if you're a caring neighbor, go over and try to convince her she needs some help. Go over and try to find out if something else is going on, depression-wise or anything else, that you might be able to help her with. But I honestly don't think APS has anything else to say about it until we I keep shifting to you, and it's not fair, but it was just you guys who made the argument. Unless we now shift, the selfish ones. Unless we now shift to the last line in here, which is neighbors are concerned about the reduction of their property values. At that point, a distributive justice argument gets underway. But guess what? A distributive justice argument has nothing to do with abuse, neglect, or exploitation. So it converts, unless one of the neighbors is an impaired adult and somehow she is now harming someone who's not in a position to care for him or herself. I mean, it could be that there's a subsidiary APS concern, which actually, believe it or not, is this one. Okay? That would translate it into this case. I see there are hands. We'll get to you. Mr. C is a 31-year-old man with intellectual disabilities who lives in a rural area with his elderly mother, who is his legal guardian. Their home is described as extremely cluttered and dirty, and it's now being reported that there is a bedbug infestation. One of the C's neighbors called APS and stated concerns that there is a young disabled man living in horrific conditions, just like what you see on those hoarding shows on television. By the way, one of the biggest problems we have with hoarding right now is that the TV shows glamorize this. Now you're collectors. You know, it's a good thing. It's not hoarding anymore. Now it's cool. The neighbor insists that APS must be removed him from the home. This case is the perfect follow-on to the first case, because if we determine in the first case that the subject individual, and that's what's so important here, is not an impaired adult who's being abused, neglected, or exploited, then APS is done. But what about a case where the subject individual actually is an impaired adult who is dependent upon a care provider who is the hoarder? Now, in that case, I don't think APS is done yet. Now they might get done, but that's going to depend on a lot of facts that we'd have to fill in to fill in the blanks. But in this case, I'm very, very concerned that we do have a dependent adult and that his care is being neglected and that hoarding is a cause of the neglect. Frankly, you want to know the truth? It doesn't matter. Hoarding in this case is almost a red herring. Who cares why mom is neglecting her son? It could be pathologically caused. It could be a hoarding disorder. It could be any other sort of disorder. It could be because she has physical disability and can't care for him anymore. Or it could be she's just a really bad person and she delights in beating up her kid. It actually, at this point, once you shift to the distributive justice argument, guess what doesn't matter anymore? Capacity. Reasons. It doesn't matter that you're doing it on purpose or you're doing it secondary to a disability. You have a responsibility to care for someone who's dependent on you, who's impaired and dependent upon you. You fail in that responsibility. We've got a neglected adult. Now, I will tell you, APS and CPS, their goal is not to split up families. So they'll do everything in their power to put wraparound supports in a case like this to try to keep a family intact. But at the end of the day, if you can't stop these bad things from happening, your subject individual is the son, not the mother. So she's allowed to be as much of a hoarder as she wants once the kid's not in harm's way. Chrissy.
So in the first case, the detail that didn't get discussed is that healthcare providers state the trash bags and boxes are stacked outside. Well, she must be getting some kind of home health care service because none of my healthcare providers know whether I've got trash bags stacked up. So I'm wondering what the conditions are, if that's a factor, the healthcare providers are coming into a house where there may not be electricity, where there's trash bags.
Well, I have to be really, really careful here, and this may be a mistake on my part. When I re-transcribed the cases that you all developed for me, clinical personnel might be an equivocation. I'm not sure if I should say clinical personnel, because I don't know if the information we have about the conditions come from the neighbors, if they come from clinical personnel in the sense of healthcare providers who are interacting with her on a regular basis, or if clinical personnel just means the APS worker who shows up at the house and does the initial evaluation.
The third sentence does say healthcare providers.
So I'm just wondering, like, is she dependent on healthcare providers to maintain living independently and is it safe conditions for people to be coming in and out of the house or administering care?
Ah, I see. You're making a different distributive justice argument.
I'm just pointing out
that No. This is clever. One distributive justice argument is she's doing something that harms the welfare of her neighbors. There's another version of this. It's a clever move. That is, we are providing clinical services in the home, which means that our staff have to go into that environment. It is an unsafe environment for those staff members to go into. So do we have an ethical justification for cleaning out the hoarding in order to make the healthcare, in order to make the environment safe for the staff that we send into it? But that is not a convincing argument if she has capacity, because then she could refuse. If we say to her, look, the only way we can send people into your house to take care of you is if you clean it up, because it's just unsafe for our people to be in that environment. I had a case where a woman, a home health nurse, fell through the floor in a trailer, and then the home health nurses were like, look, we have tried everything to help her fix the place up. She won't let any workers in there. She won't let us repair the floor. We're done sending workers in there. And there was a big tussle because management said, she needs you, you go. And the staff was saying, no way. I mean, this is just demonstrably unsafe. So we got an ethics consult out of it. The bottom line still would be there that we could convert that back into the cardiac case if we tell her we can't send healthcare providers into your home, say, to do catheter care or whatever it is you need, unless you agree to clean up the house. If she has capacity, she can say, fine, then I'll do without the healthcare. Keep your staff to yourself. We would only be able to insist that we send someone into her home on paternalistic grounds if we can demonstrate that she has diminished capacity to understand the alternatives, risks, and benefits. But that's where I thought your little whisper was going to come in, because then you say, wait a minute, she has a history of prescription drug abuse. So now let's go back and ask, is her history significant of a true diminished capacity to make these decisions? Is she acting secondary to an addiction? Maybe there's all sorts of things she wants to hide from us in that house, and it's all because of her addiction. So do we then get to go into the house?
Self-neglect.
Is there any such thing as self-neglect? I would argue self-neglect cannot take place for someone who has capacity. I don't care about physical capacity. It would have to be intellectual capacity. I would agree that self-neglect is entirely possible if she's incapable of appreciating and taking responsibility for her choice to take those risks. But if she has the intellectual capacity to understand the alternatives, risks, and benefits, and she says, I'd rather live like this,
or
I'd rather die than go to a long-term care community, which comes all back to the capacity issue again. What? APS is not the police. It's not there. Unless now we'll have to ask the officer in the back of the room. So we have a representative from the sheriff's department here. And actually, it would be an interesting question. You know, sometimes we involve law enforcement to do sort of well checks, right? You know, or I don't know what we actually call them, but we're concerned about someone at this house. Could you please go out and just make sure that, you know, they're still alive? So we send the sheriff out. An interesting question would be whether or not the sheriff would see something that would constitute probable cause to forcibly search the house.
Because the animals, a lot of them come with orders. The way they get them, they may not see anything outside the house.
Unless there's probable cause. Well, it would, but now what you're asking is a great question, but it's not now not an ethics question. It's now a law enforcement question, which is what constitutes probable cause to search the house. My guess would be this: if the odor we're smelling smells like a gas leak, and she happens, or a dead body, I'll give you a dead body. I'll give you that. A lot of cat urine, maybe. It depends on what it would be. But the point would be that the sheriff would have to have probable cause to say, I believe that something illegal is happening here and I need to search the house in order to prevent that illegality. Even if that argument goes through, the sheriff has no basis for trying to fix a hoarding problem. The sheriff only has the basis to make sure she doesn't blow up the neighborhood, to make sure that she's not being cruel to animals, and that she doesn't have some dead bodies, you know, rotting in the living room. But that's it. And if none of those things are true, I assume, sheriff, tell me, you walk out. And so what do you do? Call APS. Call it.
Everybody calls.
Call APS, yeah.
Wouldn't the odor itself, any odor, go back to the distributive justice thing where they violated a clearly defined social
obligation? Ah, excellent. Wouldn't the odor, it's a beautiful question, wouldn't the odor itself be sufficient to trigger a distributive justice argument and allow us to intervene in order to protect the neighbors from having to put up with this odor? Answer? No, it's obvious that not all odors rise to the level of harm to others. I just like cooking Mexican food. So what they're smelling are, you know, my fajitas. You're telling me that now I can't cook the food I want to cook? All right, so now here's a very interesting issue.
They don't know that that's causing the odor.
Well, look, if we don't know, and we have reason to believe that there's a risk. Again, look at the burden of proof. It can't just be, oh, well, for all we know, there's a dead body in there. It would have to be the smell smells like a dead body, which means you're a really bad cook. But it smelled like a dead body, so I had probable cause to worry about it. When I went in and I looked, I realized it wasn't a dead body. It was just a bad fajita. And then I walk away. I walk away at that point, right? It's a really bad fajita, but we had a case. I told you about the negligee woman. Same long-term care community. We had a guy. Well, I'll tell you two. One, we had a guy who wanted to stay in independent living, but he could not toilet himself, and so he would come out of his apartment with feces on his pants. And he would go down to the dining hall and sit down, and everybody is like smelling, you know, they're trying to eat lunch, and there's this odor. Okay, that's another case. Third case, we had some people, it was a couple, it was mostly her, but it was both of them. I think there was a diagnosable mental illness here, but let's just say they were really socially weird. So she would go into the dining room and like, come over to your table and say, oh, have you met my new friend? And like show you her stuffed animal. And then like you all would be talking and she would just plop herself down and join right in the conversation. And I don't even know who you are. On one occasion, there was a conference in a conference room. The administration was having a meeting with some vendors for whatever. And she walks right into the meeting and says, great to see you. It's nice to know you're bidding on this contract. I hope it goes well for you. You know, you need anything, you give me a call. She is a resident of the long-term care community. She has nothing to do with any of the business that's going on. So then a petition comes from the residents saying, you gotta keep these people out of the dining room. They're really annoying. A petition comes from the residents saying, you gotta keep this guy out of the dining room. He smells. What we argued in those cases, and it's relevant to here when we're doing distributive justice, is that annoyances are down here. Disruption is up here. Don't ask me who gets to make this call, but it's a clinical call, it's a professional call. And what we argued was mere annoyances are part of life in the big city. And you put up with it, and if you don't like it, you stay away from that person. But guess what, guys? The fact that Mr. and Mrs. Smith are annoying, just you deal with it. It's not our job to get involved in your social relationships. You don't want to talk to them, you confront them and tell them you don't want to talk to them, but that's just annoying. Feces in the dining room has now crossed a threshold of disruption. In other words, we're now preventing people from having the kind of environment that, frankly, they paid good money to have. And it's probably not that it's probably not as unhealthy as you think for him to have a little bit of yuck on his pants. You follow him with some Lysol. There are less restrictive ways to deal with that. But the point would be that now this fundamentally disrupts the type of service that we are charged to provide to other people in the environment. So the Ethics Committee argued, when you cross that threshold from a mere annoyance to a disruption, and we define disruption as a situation where we are now unable to meet the rights of others, that's the switch that then turns the distributive justice argument on, which means that the property value question is a really tough one, because I don't know at what point my neighbor kid who's annoying is just annoying, and at what point anyone who drives down the street sees what's going on over there is never going to want to buy my house. Is that now disrupting my rights as a property owner? You'd have to be able to argue yes to make this argument work. And believe me, I got some neighbors I wish weren't my neighbors. They're annoying, but they're not violating my rights. I can imagine other cases where they are violating my rights, but a bad fajita is not going to violate my rights.
Oh, but a smell of urine because the water's been off.
An excessive urine odor from the 500 cats you have might. But then, oh, he's sitting in the back now, he moved. Yeah. But then we're triggering a local ordinance that has to do with cruelty to animals and everything else. No chickens. Angela.
I don't know if I missed it, but have we looked at this from distributive justice and fire codes? Because she lives in a town.
Excellent.
Right.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. And this is an argument we made before. The distributive justice argument that I just made hinges on distinguishing between something that's merely annoying and something that actually infringes on someone else's rights. The rights you have, without a doubt, are a function of the environment in which you're living. So if I have a single-family detached dwelling on a 500-acre lot, and my house is in the middle of the lot, not right, because it could be that I have 500 acres over there, but I'm right next to another unit. But so I'm in the middle of my own 500-acre lot, single-family detached dwelling. My guess is I can play my stereo at any volume I like at any time of day. If I'm living in an apartment building, okay, then it is reasonable for my neighbors to say there's an hour after which you cannot blast your stereo. In fact, even in the middle of the day, blasting your stereo is not allowed. That's what comes up in some of these other cases. This case, the client has, you can't use a laser pointer here, what I assume is like a Section 8 voucher. Aha! People with Section 8 vouchers have additional responsibilities that people without Section 8 vouchers don't have. So when you agree to accept a public housing voucher, you are agreeing. You're signing away a certain amount of your liberty in exchange for receiving a benefit, which means you have effectively consented to the inspection of the apartment. Therefore, if the inspectors want to say, look, we have a legitimate right to inspect this apartment, and you're preventing us from doing that because of your hoarding disorder, now all of a sudden, your hoarding disorder is a perfectly relevant reason why I can force the inspection. Now, I'm still not sure it's an APS issue, but it certainly is an enforceable intervention. Okay?
Because this is on the as a condition.
Yes.
Is fair housing fair game, and is ADA...
Ah, good. Good, 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 good. ADA, wow, yeah, that's going to be like a Pandora's box, though. Yeah, but. Yeah, I know, but.
Boarding is an official.
Sure, sure. So you can't discriminate against someone on the basis of a clinical diagnosis. Okay, but the ADA does not require, ever, that is a pass on. Fine, but fair housing laws are not going to say that she has the right to destroy other people's
Correct.
Living arrangements.
Slow the roll.
It's going to slow it down. It's going to force you to look for other reasonable accommodations. It's going to do a lot of other stuff. But the ADA is not going to protect you. Just to cut to the chase, you have a job. You're a bus driver. You work for the city schools, okay? You have a terrible accident. You go blind. You come back to work and you say, hey, I want my old job back. I say, no, you can't have your old job back. You say, what? I was a bus driver. Now you're saying I can't be a bus driver. Why? Well, because you're blind. Wait a minute. You're discriminating against me on the basis of a health condition? That's a violation of the ADA. Guess what? The ADA is not going to require that I put you back behind the wheel after you're blind. Okay? Now, it is going to require that I try to, lots of paperwork, and it's even going to require that I try to find you some other sort of employment at a similar level of responsibility or pay, da-da-da-da-da, but it's not going to require that I stick you behind the wheel of a bus when you're blind. So, ADA might require that we work doubly hard to figure out other ways that we can help Mr. B and eliminate the problem, but push comes to shove, he signed that voucher. And ADA doesn't give him any more rights than the rest of us. ADA says he can't be discriminated against the way that any of the rest of us wouldn't be discriminated against. The ADA basically just says your medical condition is sort of like race, religion, sex, you know, things that you can't be used against you. But that doesn't give you a free pass. And again, APS may have nothing to do with this. This may fall into someone else's bailiwick now. Yeah.
I like loud in this policy book because our policy is defined as black and white. We have a lot of gray areas.
Oh, I never said that this is written anywhere in policy. That would be great, but I don't know if their policy is any more black and white than yours. The ethics of it might be. So what you really need to do is hire me as your ethicist and forget about the policy. That was a shameless plug, wasn't it? That was bad. Let's be fair.
Yeah.
We can outline the ethics of this and come to ethical conclusions that are readily defensible. That is not necessarily going to be the end of the fight. So I don't want to give anyone the impression that these cases are then going to just be easy. Once the ethics is clear, what you then should have is a powerful argument that frankly you should document. I'm not saying you should use me, but you should document that we've examined this. We've analyzed this. We can rule out unethical conduct now, and we can actually produce a document that says the ethically most appropriate way to deal with this is through Avenue X. Then I leave it to the professionals to actually execute Avenue X. Yep, but that's your job. So look what we've just done. We have about 15 minutes left, so we have a little bit more to go. But we started with case number one. Okay. The capacity issue seems to be extraordinarily important here because that speaks against assuming too much based on history. I think the history would be enough to get you to ask the questions about capacity, but on the assumption that you've done your job correctly and you believe that this person continues to have capacity, that you cannot determine that they have diminished capacity, then the paternalistic argument goes away. The distributive justice argument is going to be much clearer in a case like this, where the individual who is harmed secondary to the behavior of the person with the hoarding disorder is a dependent adult, an impaired adult, who needs to be protected. Okay? So in this case, we're going to protect that child, an adult child in this case. One way to protect the adult child might be to help mom deal with her hoarding. But if she determines she doesn't want help for her hoarding and is absolutely unwilling to cooperate with anything we suggest, the outcome could end up being that she can no longer keep her child in her care.
We terminate the guardianship.
We would terminate, right. We would go through whatever we needed to do and get that to happen. That leads us to a question about when we get to intervene for the welfare of others, which clearly indicates that the level of harm, shouldn't even say that, that the level of disutility that I can foist on others could in some ways be a function of the environment in which I live. People in long-term care don't like to hear this, but when you leave your home and you move into a congregant living setting, you do assume some new responsibilities and surrender some freedoms. What I've done in many, many ethics consults is I've held that single-family detached residence on one side of the spectrum. I've held an acute care hospital where you're an admitted patient on the other side of the spectrum. And then you ask, where are you on the continuum between the two? A townhome where you own the property, but it's in close proximities to others, is close to your own home, but still moving this way. An apartment complex where you are a renter and someone else has a financial interest in maintaining the re-rentability of that property after you leave is even closer down here. A college dorm, okay, is even further down this way. A skilled care unit in long-term care, further down this way, all the way until you get, look, you're a patient in my hospital and I get to decide what happens to you and what doesn't. If you don't like it, you can leave. So I want you to notice there's this continuum, and the hoarding issue will play out on that continuum as well. If you're in skilled nursing care, we can exert a lot of pressure over what happens to you with regard to hoarding because we own the property, we have an interest in maintaining the property, you are disabled and in our care because you can't care for yourself, we have a standard of care to uphold, so there's something on the line for people other than you, and you're in a congregant living setting where everything that you do in your little unit affects the people who are right next to you. That's one in one side. You're in your own townhome, never asked for help from anybody, not in my care. The neighbors just don't like some of the smell. We're closer to the other side of the continuum. Yeah.
The bed bugs.
Yeah, where were the bed bugs? Excellent. I think you're absolutely correct. You can't assume that bed bugs constitutes neglect. If that were true, most of you were neglectful because you all live in Northern Virginia and this is like the bed bug capital of the world. I hate sleeping in hotels. Anytime I come to Northern Virginia, you know what? I look at the mattress and my suitcase, I never put on the bed. I want one of those wooden fold out things, right? I don't take my clothes and stick them anywhere where anything could crawl out. I don't trust you guys. No. I have a funny story about bed bugs. I won't tell you now. There was another hand. Yes, sir.
Just for observation, on this particular case, it's not the way it's presented, it's not specific as to the codependency that the mother and son
good
have together. Perhaps the mother has potential capacity because of her age. The son, you know, with the maybe he is the one that's basically has become, in effect, the guardian of the household.
That's a fair point, except for the fact that he's an adult. He's 31, and she's his legal guardian, which means he had to have been adjudicated by the court as being incompetent. So he was designated by the court as being the dependent one. Now, if she loses her ability to provide support for him, again, it doesn't matter whether she does it because she's a mean person or she does it just because she's frail and sort of slowly has lost physical function. At some point, if she cannot do the job that needs to be done, she's remiss. We don't have to dislike her and blame her, but nevertheless, she's no longer an appropriate guardian for this guy, and some change needs to take place. But I will point out again, the burden of proof is on us to demonstrate that they cannot successfully live together as they choose. And as Chrissy points out, merely having bed bugs does not demonstrate that there's any neglect going on here. No one ever died of bed bugs.
It doesn't say that the mother is the hoarder. Perhaps he's the hoarder.
Well, that is possibly the case. But I think the way the case was presented to me was we're worried because there's hoarding going on and this guy is subjected to neglect because of the quality that mom's maintaining the house. It could be, I could tell the same story over again and it still doesn't change the ethical outcome. It could be that he's the hoarder and she's incapable of controlling his hoarding behavior so that now we get back to self-neglect. Fine, but she's in a position of responsibility to make sure that he's safe. If he's safe, done.
Safe enough.
There's a threshold. It's always a threshold. Listen, nobody ever has to choose an optimal outcome. People can choose to live in what you would consider to be clearly suboptimal. There is a minimum standard of care. There's a minimum level of health and safety below which dependent adults cannot fall. But you can choose to live in some pretty unhealthy environments. If it doesn't meet that minimum threshold, fine, that's a life choice they get to make. They get to smoke, they get to drink, right? But you've got a dependent adult. She has been appointed the legal guardian. She has a responsibility to keep him safe. If his safety falls below that minimum threshold, then we need to intervene. If she did it on purpose, that's one thing. If she didn't do it on purpose, it still means we need to help him.
So in the case of the townhomes and there's a smell,
yeah,
one of the neighbors is somehow impaired on their breathing, COPD, or even asthma, and the smell is affecting them. But that neighbor is not impaired in any way. That neighbor is fully capable within.
Excellent. I love it.
Actually, I'm going to take it two different ways. So now, part of my hoarding is my perfume collection. The neighbor next door has a bad allergy to perfume. So there's a health risk associated with it. First of all, clearly distributive justice can play. But this is all what we skipped. I went too fast. The risk of harm to others is more significant than the harm generated by restricting the client's freedom and is not protected by an identified right. That last little phrase I just leapfrogged over before, and I have to come back and tell you. I have certain rights, okay? If you can't tolerate my rights, if what I have is a clearly identified right, then the burden's on you to get out of my way. So if I go into a public place and start smoking and expose you to secondhand smoke, a distributive justice works perfectly well that says, you can stop me from doing that because I'm exposing you to a risk that you don't want to be exposed to, dot, dot, dot. But if I invite you over to my house for dinner and I smoke, then, and you say, oh, you can't do that. I have severe asthma and, it's going to be a problem. I get to say, you want to be in my house? You put up with my smoke. You don't want to be in my house? Leave.
What if it's going through the vent?
All right.
The other home.
Well, but even so, what we would have to know is whether or not I have a right to behave the way I do, even if it may have some residual impact on others. For instance, I think it is, I'm just going to say it, and some of you will hate me for this, but you don't know if I really believe it, because it could be bait. But it is absurd to tell parents that they're not allowed to give their kid a peanut butter sandwich to bring to school, because for all you know, there might be someone else in the school who has a peanut allergy, and if they traded lunches or whatever, some people have severe allergies, that some other kid is so fragile that if there's a peanut anywhere in the building, then they're going to die. And I would have to argue that if you are so fragile that if there's a peanut anywhere in the building, you might die, you don't belong in that building, because we cannot guarantee a peanut-free environment. So you shouldn't have peanuts, and your mother should not pack you a lunch with a peanut, and you should be taught not to share people's lunches that come from, anywhere else. But if you can't manage your own risk, that doesn't necessarily mean that you get to infringe the rights of someone else to have a peanut butter sandwich.
But in your own home, you bought this home, you purchased this home, paid hundreds of thousands of dollars for this home. Your neighbor is causing a smell to come into your home that you've purchased. You can't easily leave that home, and it's an unreasonable smell. It's
But that's... I'm going to repeat. You got to let her finish talking before I can repeat. The point the claim that was just made was, so you own your own house, but you collect your perfume or your peanuts or whatever it is, and it creates a smell that invades someone else's property, and they've spent money on their house, and now they can't get away from that smell, but they now have invested a lot of money there. Well, the problem with your statement is that you said that you've created an unreasonable smell.
Well, it's unreasonable because it's affecting their health.
No. Affecting their health is not enough to make it unreasonable.
How can that possibly not be unreasonable if it's plunging them into an...
Because I have no responsibility, if you are hypersensitive to something, to make sure that there's not one part per gazillion of peanut smell in the air you breathe. If you're that sensitive, buy a bubble. It's not my responsibility at some point. Now, because the word responsible is the key word there. In other words, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. If I have, you know, gallons of peanut butter and big fans because I like to have peanut smell, and so I'm blowing peanut smell all over my property, and I can't possibly contain it over my property line, I'm doing something clearly that is not protected by an identified right. I am doing something now that goes beyond any reasonable standard as to what you would expect for people who are living in an environment with each other. But if I just happen to be sitting at home with perfume and you just happen to be so sensitive that you can smell perfume from a quarter mile away, well, but yes, it is what you're talking about. It is your... No, but the reason that it is what you're talking about is that if you make the argument... Now, you have to know how I think. So just have fun with this for a little bit, okay? You said that the existence of a health risk to another was a sufficient reason to think that it was unreasonable. All I need is one example where you create a health risk for someone else, and in fact, you're acting reasonably in order to prove that you cannot claim that the mere existence of a health risk to others is sufficient to justify a conclusion that I'm doing something unethical. So then I need to go back and say, so what's the magnitude of the risk? How far in space? How many mitigating options are there that we've either tried or not tried? You're going to have to tell me a lot more to know or to be able to demonstrate that when I place you at risk, I'm doing so in an irresponsible manner. The mere fact that you are at a health risk does not mean that I have been irresponsible in projecting that risk on you. So you need to establish something beyond the existence of the health risk. And it would be something like, you're living in close congregant settings where we know that noise and smells carry. And you agreed to that. You know, you have a lease that says you can't ruin other people's lives. Or you have a Section 8 voucher that says, you know, you have to submit to inspections and you have to upkeep the property, et cetera, et cetera. But you got to point to something there because the burden of proof is on you. For all I know, you're allergic to me. And just by being in this room, I'm going to make you sick, okay? I have that effect on people, right? So me just being in this room makes you sick. It doesn't mean I've done anything wrong by being in this room. Unless I irresponsibly project something that makes you sick. In that case, you have a claim. But we're at 4 o'clock. I'm going to have to conclude. I'll take one last. If you had a lease that said you shouldn't have cats, you own a house. So in other words, on your own property. That's a perfect example. It's a perfect example.
Real quick, for just one thing clinically.
Clinically, one last thing clinically.
When you talk to someone with hoarding disorder, you know how you have the reaction to them? If you say to them, so you're, and they're arguing with you that you shouldn't even be there, that this is fine, that there's no problem with it. If you can ask them, so your house is exactly the way you want it, this is exactly the way you want it, usually they'll say, no, I intend to clean it later. And then if you follow up with a statement like, well, tell me what you would clean later. You're not going to do it now, but later. Tell me how you'd start a different dialogue and be less, we're talking about, this is not ethics, but it's a different way of approaching people to try to get services rather than getting them to an ethical consult because we can clinically keep moving along. So just say that, and they'll tell you they're stressed about their own disorder.
And we have to quit. There's going to be a closing announcement, I perceive. But listen, I'm worried as an ethicist about when intervention is ethically justified or not. There are all sorts of great techniques for improving outcomes. Great, learn them. But at the end of the day, if the person says, no, get out of my face, we're back to the ethics question. And that's all that we've tried to analyze today. What rights do people have to make their own choices, even if they're unwise choices? And I'll quit there.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.